and welcome to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. I'm Naomi Fowler. Coming up later, has the UK just seen its first Tax Justice general election?
The lesson from the unexpected failure of the Conservatives to gain a majority in the election is that policies that promote the role of tax in building a fair and civilised society and promise also to ensure that all individuals and companies pay the tax they're supposed to pay are actually popular policies.
We also look at the popular shift towards a tax justice movement in the United States. But first, here's a quick roundup of this month's Tax Justice news. If you ever doubted that trusts are the new black for people wanting to hide what they're up to, it's worth taking a look at what happened when New Zealand tried to clean up its seedy foreign trust business by introducing a new financial transparency law this month. With just under 12,000 trusts recorded, apparently only 66 have registered to supply the further information now required. 1,838 trusts have already gone, and about 10,000 seem to be dithering. The European Commission's just announced its proposals to target the enabler industry of tax abuse, meaning tax advisers and related professionals would have to report to tax authorities any cross-border schemes with potentially aggressive tax planning elements they're offering their clients. A welcome step, but it won't be made public. The European Parliament also held a crucial tax justice vote this month on making multinational companies with an annual net turnover of €750 million and above publicly report their activities, structures and tax payments on a country-by-country basis. The vote went well, but a last-minute amendment was tabled, giving nation-states the possibility to grant exclusions for multinationals if they considered information to be commercially sensitive. In Germany, a whistleblower, apparently a young admin assistant, noticed that an international group of bankers, lawyers and stockbrokers, apparently with links to the City of London, have been fiddling the tax system, depriving the state of nearly €32 billion. And finally, the BVI just published a report saying they're not a tax haven. The report was put together by Capital Economics, known for their reports, saying exactly the same about Jersey. You may remember on the TaxCast we've pointed out the Panama Papers scandal could just as well have been called the BVI Papers, since this British overseas territory was such a favourite of the offshore law firm Mossack Fonseca. It turns out the BVI is doing even better than before with its anonymity for sale model. Estimates on the total assets of its companies are double what they were in 2010. The BVI imposes global tax losses on the rest of us of $37.5 billion every year. They deny they're a tax haven or that they sell secrecy. Well, that's easy to fix. All they have to do is create a public register of the real owners of companies, trusts and foundations. Those are the Tax Justice headlines. Now we're going to talk to John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network for his take on this month. OK, John, so in the UK we've had a snap general election. It turned out to be all about austerity, really, and not about Brexit. At the Tax Justice Network, we are non-aligned politically, but we do have to say that the Labour Party at last did put forward a manifesto with a series of great tax and economic policies. We said on edition 45 of the TaxCast for regular listeners back in 2015 that the election of Jeremy Corbyn as leader was a game changer. They're not laughing so much now, are they? And tax topped the election agenda this time, which is very unusual. Many of us feel this was the most important general election since 1945. There really was a stark choice between holding on to the post-war kind of social gains or losing them. And the Prime Minister's Conservative Party looked set for a landslide. But in the short time available to explain its policies, the Labour Party got incredible traction with voters. And we've now ended up with a significantly weakened Conservative government that's not likely to last very long. Over and over again through the election cycle, politicians got away with constantly repeating that there's no such thing as a magic money tree and that we can't afford the public services we used to have. and we must live within our means. That's their favourite one. The debate generally on economics and tax in the mainstream media was pretty bad, wasn't it?
Yes, extraordinary times, and some of the comments about where money comes from need to be questioned, particularly this assumption that an economy is run like a household. It quite simply isn't. The idea, which sounds so sensible, that money doesn't grow on trees, does need to be challenged. Because, of course, governments, states are not households. They have this extraordinary power to create money. And if they don't create money, then the economy doesn't work.
Right, and Labour made a series of tax pledges in their manifesto, things like taxing the top 5% of earners a bit more, raising the corporate income tax back up from its historic low levels, and lots of other things. But when it comes to creating money or borrowing it, if the state stops talking about costs and starts thinking about investments that would pay off as any good investment would, it changes all the choices governments make, doesn't it? And contrary to what many politicians told voters during this election, for governments, money kind of does grow on trees.
Yes, I mean, the state can do two things. It can borrow money, and it can borrow money very cheap. And government bonds are very low risk, by and large. Governments can borrow very much more cheaply than most of us can, and most businesses can. Many of them are AAA rated. The government is in the unique position of being able to create money, to issue that money into the economy quite happily, without creating inflationary effects, and if there are inflationary effects, it can use the tax system to withdraw the money from the economy in order to reduce any inflationary effects that emerge. So governments can borrow a lot of money if they wanted to invest. But more importantly, governments can create money because they have the license to create money. As we've seen with the quantitative easing programme, if the government wants to issue money, it can do so.
Well, it's just printing money, and actually they gave that to the banks.
Well, no, there was the problem. I'm afraid the banks just went back to business as usual. The banks didn't do what banks should be doing. And there is a structural problem for the UK economy, and I suspect for many other economies, which is that the banks no longer see their role as the kind of boring stuff of collecting deposits and distributing those deposits back into the local economy by lending onto businesses. They're no longer even equipped to do that. They've abandoned all of that a long time ago. They're much more interested in the speculative stuff. Which is one of the reasons why the Labour Party in their manifesto were talking about the need for a national investment bank, because this high-level investment is no longer being done very effectively by the private sector.
The Conservatives do like their sort of reputation as being good with business. So, I mean, if we move away from this idea of a household budget into the idea of, not that it is, but the state is a business, and that, you know, society is a business, then it seems really obvious that you would invest money in order to make it succeed.
Well, look, in the 1950s and 1960s and through into the 1970s, it was accepted that the state had a crucial role. And this was the period of sustained growth right the way across the Western world. The state had a crucial role in investing in the long-term technology development and so on, which fed through eventually into things like the smartphone. There's a very well-respected economist, Mariano Mazzucato, who's written about the role of the state as the entrepreneurial state, which creates the right environment for private sector businesses to thrive. And that doesn't mean cutting taxes, which seems to have been the thinking of the bean counters for the last 40 years. You know, cut wages, cut taxes, cut regulation. That doesn't create a stimulating business environment. All it does is it shifts, it redistributes wealth from the many, particularly from workers, to the people who own the businesses. And it can have long-term catastrophic consequences. What we need to recognise is that government plays a very crucial role in helping to create the long-term changes, the shift, for example, to a green technology base, creating the right research and development institutions and funding and all of that, but also in doing what's called pump priming.
So to go back to the analogy of a business, if they can borrow at a certain percentage and they get a return on their investment by investing in positive productive things like people, infrastructure and all the rest of it, it kind of makes sense, doesn't it?
Absolutely, it does make sense. one of the commitments of the Labour Party in their manifesto was to renationalise water. In my own personal experience, my water rates have more than doubled in real terms. It's the same bloody water. The investment never happened. So they're proposing to renationalise them, and people say, well, where do you get the money from? Well, governments can quite simply issue a bond, because let's face it, water companies generate a lot of money. Those bonds would be paid for by the income that is received from that. So the idea that the government couldn't afford to do this was nonsense. It's quite clear the economic commentators were saying this couldn't happen, it's not costed, don't understand how you run a business, let alone how you run a government. Most of them, I think, now need to go away and perhaps go back to school and learn a bit about economics.
So if, in fact, the government makes a choice to borrow money at very low rate of interest, not only would it be cost neutral, it would actually bring a really healthy return back into the public purse.
Oh, let's be clear. Nationalising the water industry would not only pay for the cost of buying back the companies, it would also yield huge profits to the Treasury as a result of this ideology of privatising everything and letting the market work. We've now have British waterworks companies, British railways, British electricity producers belonging to state industries from other countries, state-run monopolies from other countries who are charging monopolistic prices, who are overcharging British consumers in order to be able to subsidise their consumers in their own countries. It's an extraordinary situation to be in, and it's all part of, the madness of not understanding how economies work.
Last question. The mainstream media, as we've said, has had a very bad election. They called it wrong throughout, interviewed the same old commentators who got a lot of things wildly wrong. Yet again, their weakness when it comes to covering economics was exposed. And throughout the election, there were wall-to-wall interviews, it seemed, on the BBC and others with the IFS, the Institute for Fiscal Studies. They were never challenged about their claims that some of the tax justice and economic manifesto proposals wouldn't work. They described themselves as Britain's leading independent microeconomic research institute. I mean, I guess the clue's in the name, right? Micro rather than macroeconomics. So, bean counters, just what we don't need.
Well, who are they? The Institute of Fiscal Studies has been around for many decades. They've put themselves into a position of being seen as the leading policy wonks in Britain, independent policy wonks. I've debated with them several times, and I'm afraid I don't hold them in very high respect. I think the IFS, the Institute of Fiscal Studies, have actually been abusing their position of preeminence for a very long time. I see them as very much part of what's wrong with the mainstream media, who always go to the same people and never say, OK, what are your assumptions built on? We had the Institute of Fiscal Studies time and time again during this election cycle talking about how if the Labour Party increased the corporate income tax rate to 26%, this would harm the interests of consumers and workers, because the companies would pass this increased tax on to consumers and on to workers. Now, this debate has been going around for the last 20 or so years. The research in the United States by the Congressional Budget Office suggests that actually, far from being able to pass it on to consumers or workers, the tax charge is ultimately paid for by the shareholders. Now, the Institute of Fiscal Studies seems to pay no attention to that, and that's because essentially they're only looking at micro issues, they're not looking at the bigger picture. The assumption which seems to lie at the heart of their model, and I've discussed it with them, is that tax cuts will stimulate investment. Where's the evidence? Tax cuts in Britain have not fed through to higher investment, in fact, quite the opposite. So the thinking is out of date, and they got it very, very badly wrong indeed. The Institute of Fiscal Studies is one of those organisations that needs a radical rethink before they are fit for purpose.
Thanks, John. John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. How much do people believe in paying their taxes? And how much do they care about who pays and who doesn't pay them? This month, the TaxCast looks at the United States and the UK. Are we seeing a popular shift towards tax justice?
As we approach the deadline to file taxes, large protests took place across the country to pressure President Donald Trump to release his tax returns.
Ho, ho! Donald Trump has got to go!
Chanting, holding signs saying, show us the money and show us your tax returns, part of a nationwide campaign calling on President Donald Trump to release his tax returns.
And I think it's only right, whether it's a Republican, whether it's a Democrat, whether it's an independent, that we know, that we're aware of where the money comes from.
The rally called tax.
Since 1976, pretty much every US presidential candidate has released some kind of tax return. President Trump says he's not released any of his because he's being audited. He was legally obliged to publish details on his personal financial holdings, but without his tax returns, it's impossible to establish the amount of tax he's actually contributed to the country he's now in charge of, or what potential conflicts of interest there could be. Hillary Clinton famously challenged Donald Trump on this issue during her ill-fated campaign running for president.
Maybe he doesn't want the American people, all of you watching tonight, to know that he's paid nothing in federal taxes, because the only years that anybody's ever seen were a couple of years when he had to turn them over to state authorities when he was trying to get a casino license, and they showed he didn't pay any federal income tax. So if he's paid zero, that means zero for troops, zero for vets, zero for schools or health. And I think probably he's not all that enthusiastic about having the rest of our country see what the real reasons are, because it must be something really important, even terrible, that he's trying to hide. And the financial disclosure statement, they don't give you the tax rate. They don't give you all the details that tax returns would.
So how did Trump's comment go down with the people watching that debate? We've heard so much about the Tea Party movement that swept across the United States, demanding, among other things, lower taxes for all.
On many fronts, I think that Donald Trump's behavior does not represent the views of most Americans. It is absolutely the case that Americans do not see avoiding paying the taxes you're supposed to pay as smart. They see it as unethical.
Vanessa Williamson is a governance studies fellow at the Brookings Institution.
They have a strong civic commitment, a strong shared commitment to the idea that tax paying is your responsibility. And Americans have exceptionally high commitment to that idea and exceptionally high actual tax compliance. I think it's a very striking disconnect between the kind of politics that we have at a national level in this country in terms of taxation, and that has basically no bearing on the preferences that Americans express when you ask them in polls.
Right, and that's exactly what you did, isn't it?
Yes. So what I did was I looked at surveys for the last 40 years, and I did interviews for things that the surveys weren't very good at capturing. And I found that Americans are actually strikingly committed. Americans see taxpaying as an important civic responsibility. And, you know, they even use the word taxpayer as kind of a shorthand for being a contributing citizen. And so people take it very seriously when they think someone's not paying their taxes. But the problem is that Americans underestimate the taxes paid by poor people, and they underestimate the taxes paid by immigrants. But Americans understand very clearly that there are multinational corporations. They've put jobs overseas and they're hiding their money overseas, and that's money that should be taxed in the United States if they're American companies.
And in order to show just how strong your research found that consensus on paying tax is among US citizens, you used a really eye-catching way to demonstrate it. Well, it makes me laugh anyway.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, so it's very, very rare to get near consensus views on poll questions. I mean, partly because we don't ask questions that get near consensus views, right? Because people agree on it. So I was trying to explain how uncommon it is that you ask a survey question and you get 90%+ of people agreeing on it. And so regularly Americans are asked whether they see it as a civic duty to pay their fair share of taxes. And the answers are, you know, always in this 91, 92, 94, 95% agreement, right? And, you know, I was trying to find any comparable survey statistics on this. And the only ones you can find are for really outlandish things, right? So if 6% of Americans don't see paying taxes as a civic duty, that's about the same percentage that think the moon landing was faked or that Elvis Presley is still alive, right? That's the level of strange you have to get to before you can find data like this, because this really is just something that almost all Americans believe.
And it is really interesting as well that you found US Americans also overwhelmingly believe that the wealthy and corporations aren't paying their fair share, which obviously is the case. And it is the top issue, in fact, for nearly two-thirds of Americans. So even when corporate tax avoidance is legal, which too often it unfortunately is because of the way the laws work, most Americans believe corporations should be punished for that and they shouldn't be eligible for things like government contracts and things like that. So what's really interesting to me is that this is a vote winner, and yet we're not quite there yet, are we? I mean, it's always a mystery how you can persuade people on minimum wage, for example, to vote for something that's against their own interests. But these tax marches across the United States do seem to reflect what your research has indicated.
So one of the things that interests me, I think, about the tax marches, I mean, first of all, that you can get a bunch of people to rally about taxes, a bit surprising, frankly. I mean, often people see taxes as this very dull issue, but if you ask them about it, they get very, very emotional quite quickly. So I think it's interesting to see people getting mobilized around this issue. One of the really interesting phenomena right now is the move by at least part of the left to make government more visible, right? I think we went through a long period, sort of in our country, the Reagan period and thereafter, where Democrats wanted to do good things for people via the government, but they wanted to hide that, right? Because they had sort of given up the ghost on defending government as a good in people's lives, as a necessity to building a fairer society. And I think that, we do social programs through the tax code a lot in this country, ways of creating sort of social benefits that were less visible to people. Well, one of the problems with that is when you hide social benefits, then people can't defend them as voters because they don't know they're getting them, right? And so one of the things that was, I think, very interesting about the Bernie Sanders campaign that talked about expanding what government does, right? And, Medicare for all for us was an enormous step in terms of being able to talk about what government does for people and talk honestly about the fact that that costs money. Right. So I think one thing that you've seen is a shift on the left towards trying to make what government does more clear to people, which I think is a more honest approach and a more respectful approach in terms of thinking about the voters. But it's also a really dramatic shift from what has been sort of the Democratic position on how we talk about government. And so, yeah, I think that it'll be very interesting to see whether Democrats like Bernie Sanders or people like Elizabeth Warren continue to talk about government, to talk about taxes in a more direct way and sort of trust that the American people can weigh the costs and benefits. That's really clear.
And over in the UK, we've just had a test of exactly that. How much voters like the idea of fairer taxes for corporations and for the top 5% of earners, for example. That's been tested for what feels like the first time in what we might say was Britain's first tax justice general election.
Good evening and welcome to the BBC Election Centre. Tonight is the third time in just over 2 years that we've come here to discover the result of a major UK-wide poll. There are just over 20 seconds to go till Big Ben strikes 10. Then I'll be able to reveal the results of the BBC, ITV and Sky joint poll. And what we're saying is the Conservatives are the largest party. Note, they don't have an overall majority at this stage. 314 for the Conservatives.
Well, David, if these numbers are correct, then Theresa May has played a high-risk political game, and she appears she may have lost her gamble. Just a few weeks ago, at the start of the campaign, she seemed almost unassailable. But a very shaky few weeks and an insurgent Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn may well have dashed the Conservatives' hopes. Now, this exit poll result, it's worth saying, is not what either of the main parties have been predicting. Privately, this would be another political surprise, with both the British public again defying the expectations of the two largest.
During election campaigns over the last few decades, you tend to see a distinction between the Conservatives positioning themselves as the low tax party and Labour as higher tax, higher public spending. Although, of course, at various points, both parties have tried to portray themselves as being the party of tax cutting.
Will Snell of Tax Justice UK.
But what we found in the debate in the run-up to this general election has been that the discussion has been less about which party is going to reduce taxes the most and more about which will raise them and how. The lesson from the unexpected failure of the Conservatives to gain a majority in the election is that policies that promote the role of tax in building a fair and civilised society and promise also to ensure that all individuals and companies pay the tax they're supposed to pay are actually popular policies. And it's not accurate to assume that everyone sees tax as a necessary evil that needs to be minimised as far as possible.
Right. And I should say this was a surprise election. It was called at very short notice. There wasn't much time for politicians to get across their manifestos. It was assumed, and certainly I thought, it was going to be a bloodbath. Most people thought Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party would be annihilated. Politicians seem to have believed for decades that you can't put forward a tax justice agenda because people won't vote for it. There are other limiting problems we've talked about before on the tax cast around media ownership by offshore billionaires and a widespread lack of understanding of economics by journalists, except for the dominant neoliberal economic narrative that seems to have endured as a kind of common sense. There was a lot of important debate going on through social media communities outside of all that. Will, Tax Justice UK did an independent analysis from a tax justice perspective of the mainstream party manifestos. Tell me what you found.
We scored each party's tax pledges against a set of 10 criteria. And those were in four areas. So tax transparency, the UK's secrecy network, tax competition and tax fairness. And we scored each party against these criteria and found that of the parties we looked at, the Labour Party came out on top with a score of 77 out of the possible 100s, closely followed by the Greens, the Liberal Democrats and the Scottish National Party a bit lower down, and then the Conservatives and UKIP at the bottom. So what we found was that while some parties have been putting forward some really excellent tax justice policies, others were promoting a much more regressive agenda, and this has presented voters with a very clear choice in terms of tax issues at the general election.
Do you feel, as certainly I do, that this is the first time I can recall tax being at the top of an agenda during a general election? It's usually immigration. We were told it was going to be all about Brexit, but it turned out that it seemed to be all about austerity and the reasons for it. Has this been the UK's first tax justice general election?
I think in many ways it has, and I think what's also worth commenting on is the extent to which many parties, in particular, but not only the Labour Party and the Green Party, have made tax justice as part of a wider push on inequality and social justice a central issue of their campaign, despite those early expectations that the campaign was going to be all about Brexit.
Right. So I wonder if we can talk a little bit about what sort of policies, tax policies and proposals we've seen in these manifestos that we haven't seen before. I mean, the particularly interesting ones, it seems to me, is the idea about reversing austerity by taxing the top 5% of earners a bit more, raising corporation tax. And Labour's manifesto on page 124 had proposals to force some of the UK's satellite havens to create public registers of the real owners, directors and major shareholders of all companies and trusts. That's something I don't think has ever been in a mainstream political party manifesto before. Am I right?
As far as I know, that is right. And yes, I think the example of Labour's proposal to compel Britain's crown dependencies and overseas territories to adopt new transparency standards would be a major step forward. But it was hard to escape the feeling, having read the manifestos, that there wasn't really any party that was trying to make a genuine attempt to deal with the extent to which Britain's economy is geared to the needs of the financial sector and recognising that the financial sector's interests do not necessarily match the interests of the wider country and the wider UK population. And I think that, you know, we're now 10 years after the financial crisis, and it's clear that the key risk factors that led to that crisis haven't really been addressed. So I think there is a need for politicians, you know, to stand up and say that there are much more fundamental issues in terms of how the economy is run and and is in whose interests it is being run and decisions are being made. And that needs to happen.
Back to Vanessa Williamson. Vanessa, in the UK, and I hope it's getting closer as well in the United States, we are now in a situation where there is a proper mainstream political challenge to the whole economic project of Reagan and Thatcher. Tax cuts are not delivering what was promised. Austerity's had a long rule and people don't like it. So what now in your view?
I guess a major challenge, right, to come up with a new story about a more, frankly, more accurate story about how the economy works. But I'm enough of an optimist to think that, you know, if you believe that there are things government should be doing for people, if you think there are ways in which government should protect people who fall on hard times, or the way government should prevent levels of wealth accumulation that genuinely threaten the democratic process, then stand up for those beliefs in an explicit and straightforward way and put those arguments to the voters and to the people and make your case, as opposed to being kind of wishy-washy about it and sort of maybe secretly believing that, but thinking that you can't tell people. You know, perhaps we're seeing a period in which people are a little bit more upfront about what they think government should and should not be doing.
You've been listening to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. I've been talking to Vanessa Williamson of the Brookings Institute and author of Read My Lips, Why Americans Are Proud to Pay Taxes. You can also check out Tax Justice UK's analysis of Britain's general election manifestos on www.taxjustice.uk. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next month.